señores y señoras, y bienvenidos a la Tramedy Podcast. Me llamo Kenneth Allen.
How's everybody doing out there in podcast land? Oh, so many things to report, so many things. Where do I begin? Well, I'm not recording this at UNITED Studios in Berkeley, California. No, in fact, I have traveled across the continent. Yay. I have traveled across the Atlantic, where I now sit reporting to you from a satellite station in a little hostel in Madrid, Spain. That's right. I'm bringing the podcast to Europe, ladies and gentlemen. This started off as a Bay Area thing. It's blowing up. We're going transcontinental. Bublam. And along the way, I'm interviewing some really interesting people. People I'm meeting along the way. Some new friends, some old friends, some good friends. Case in point, this interview now. Listen, this is fantastic. I got my good friend on here, Josh Smith. I went to paramedic school with him back in 05. And Josh has since gone on to greatness working as a paramedic in San Francisco. And then about a year ago, decided to pull up his roots, travel, leaving his job behind, leaving his friends behind, leaving his family behind, to come to Spain to study to gain his master's degree. And it is such an amazing feat on his part. Josh got his master's degree and wrote his thesis on how to handle a large-scale emergency incident in a mass gathering. So I'm not going to get into it. I'll let him do it for you. It's fantastic, and it's very interesting on how he decided to set this up. It reminds me of Joseph Campbell. You know, he says, follow your bliss. And furthermore, the hero's quest, where the hero has to leave his place of comfort, the system, the confines of the machine in which he's in, to travel outside of it to seek his own truth, his own destiny. And that's what Josh did. So as far as I'm concerned, it's exactly what he did. He braved the threat of losing his job. He got a leave of absence. They said they weren't going to give him another leave of absence. It's never been done in San Francisco. Yet he continued. He pursued the path, and he stayed on track. And now he's attained it. And he's coming back to San Francisco. He slayed the dragon, ladies and gentlemen. And he's coming back with the dragon's blood. This thesis that he wrote, and the city he wrote it for is for San Francisco. So he's bringing back to the city this treasure, this truth, this knowledge, this game plan to save them, to help them. It's a metamorphosis. It's to me, the most inspirational example of what we are as humans seeking. We're trying to find our own path, our own truths, and our own meaning within this giant, giant machine. And hopefully bring something back to maybe fix the machine, maybe alter the machine in a different way, maybe do a little, you know, little wrench turning on or something. Who knows? Whatever your bliss is, whatever you like doing, go out there and do it. And don't worry about people telling you, no, you can't do this. If you really want to do it, you really have to work hard for it. There was a lot of nights, I'm sure, that he had to deal with sitting at home, writing and reading and studying. But if you pursue it, you find all these little things that come along, these little helpers, this person who might know this guy who you can talk to, or someone that can help you along the way. And that, to me, is the real miracle of life. If you have your eyes open and your ears and you're ready and you're listening for what you want, you will find these people and these little things that pop up. And literally it's like, you finally showed up. Here it is. Here's the next message. Here's the next clue. Move on from here. It's this beautiful scavenger hunt that's hard, frustrating at times, scary most of the time, but incredibly rewarding. Because I think in the end, really, you feel alive and you feel this trust for yourself because you went after this thing and you attained it despite all the adversities. To me, Josh is a modern day hero. He's inspired me. I'm looking for the truth out there, and I'm looking for my own destiny every day. And to have somebody that also is doing that is a reaffirmation that I'm on the right path. So Josh, thank you again for coming on. Meanwhile, you ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're on your own path. You deserve to be. You should be. Remember, if you're scared, you don't know which way to go, you don't know if I should go on this trip, right? A good friend of mine used to say, you really want to go find adventure? You want to take that trip? Just buy the ticket. Go buy the plane ticket. Now you have to go. Now you're going. And as soon as you step outside that door, go into that airport, the adventure starts with each step. Man, it feels good and it's shaky, and you're moving forward towards destiny. It's a beautiful thing, and I'm really alive now, and I feel great being here. And I've had a great time with Josh. He's been not just a great interviewee, but also a great tour guide through Spain. And I'm going to be moving on from here in a few days, but I wanted to bring this to y'all out there just because I'm feeling so good about it. Remember, follow your bliss. Buy the ticket. You'll find that revelation. You'll find what Sean Connery says when in Crusade. And when Harrison Ford says, and what did you find, Dad? That's a terrible Harrison Ford. Let's see. And what did you... It sounds like... it's like, what, Michael J. Fox doing Harrison Ford? Hang on. And what did you find, Dad? And to which Sean Connery says, illumination. So, find, let he who illuminated this illuminate me. So, go find that thing that you love and seek some reward. Seek, not a reward, seek putting your energy into it. Give. We have to give our lives to something in life. Make it be that thing that makes you blissful, that gives you a sense of meaning. And, you know, have a few beers along the way. Have a few laughs. You'll never regret that. So this is us in San Sebastian, Spain. My first night there, rocking and rolling in a little cafe. And we had some antipasti. No, I'm sorry. We had some pinchos, you know, tapas deal. And we had some wine going and a couple glasses. It was fantastic. I will always remember this. And I'm pushing forward, ever onward, always looking forward, always looking in. I'm feeling it, ladies and gentlemen. It is the now, and it is the movement to the future and the past. But being the hub of the wheel, you're not up or down, you're right in the middle, moving forward. This is Kenneth Allen signing off. Remember, if you have some friends and family that might like this damn show, put them in contact with me. I'll make it worth their while as well. And I hope you're having a good time out there, and I hope you're following with us. I love you. Cheers. Enjoy the show.
Salud.
So we're dealing with the environment, got the wind factor taken care of. Let's do this.
Is that gonna work?
Apparently not, because I could already see it like flashing like, hey man, it's too loud. Is there no way to... I just want to move the table over or something.
Look at the other option, maybe that table behind those.
That was the one I was looking at, but it might be, there's no heat lamp there. Well, Josh is going to get cold. I can't get cold like that.
Yeah, sniffle. Here, I'll try and provide some wind blockage.
All right. So, bro, we are hot right now.
All right.
Welcome to the Trombie Podcast from lovely San Sebastian, Spain. That's right. I'm sitting with my good buddy Josh Smith. I just left the hostel, sitting at Goit Got, having a glass of red, some peanuts, maybe some pintos, this place.
watching all the tourists go by.
There's a couple dogs. There is a clock tower that will chime in and give you some ambient noise. Just deal with it.
And plenty of rain.
And fucking rain. Unfortunately, we do have some rain. What are you going to do? I came here looking for sun and surf, and I got llueve. Pero, está bien, está bien. No problem. Josh, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing excellent. I mean, I'm in Spain. It's really not... That's an answer under
itself.
Kind
of a feeling, too, right now.
It's just kind of like... just by definition, that means good.
España.
So far, so good.
There are many things to see in España. I've been working on my Castilian accent.
Yeah?
Sure.
Excellent.
Sure.
Excellent.
Yeah, I usually say sir, but sure. In España. España. What is that? Didn't that come from a king?
What?
That had a cleft palate?
That's what I heard. And then everyone had to
incorporate that.
Had to do the lisp, basically. I can't do it. I mean, there's certain words I'll pronounce that way, but I just can't do it. I can't.
I know. I can't roll my R's. That's the one issue I have with Spanish. Perro. But I do it in the back of my throat rather than up against the lip. How do you do it? How do you do that?
I don't know. It changes the meaning of the word, too. So
perro
versus perro, you know, dog versus butt.
Yeah. Dog butt.
The conjunction, not the...
Just a B-U single T.
Not the body part.
Yeah. What is butt, then? Derriere.
In Spanish?
Yeah.
There's many versions, but this is... I'm assuming this is a family podcast, so... I'll keep them limited.
Sans the one expletive I've already used. So, Josh has just finished... Let's get into it. Josh just finished his master's.
Almost. One test to go.
Okay. But well, knock on priest, ancient plaster.
Stone.
Yeah. Josh just is in the process of finishing his master's that he studied for in Madrid, Spain. And the thesis was, Josh, you want to go into it?
Well, the master's itself, what they say it is management of emergency security and crisis. I'm not exactly sure what we did study. There's a lot more management than security and crisis, but it was pretty interesting. But what I chose for my final paper was looking at the provision... God, what is the actual title? It's the provision of medical care at mass gatherings.
Provision of medical care at mass gatherings.
Yes.
Okay. So we're talking about MCIs.
The preparing for the potential for an MCI.
The large MCI, not the car accident or the boiler explosion, but the...
Just anything. It was kind of based from the experience from the 2010 World Series parade and then New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve, right.
Just kind of looking around at
2011.
Huge mass of people and realizing that I didn't really think we were... totally prepared to handle it if there was an escalating event during the event. So, like when you look at the history of mass gatherings, you know, there's just a long history of disasters happening at mass gatherings. So, the idea was just to kind of look into that and what could we do to be better prepared.
Gotcha. And you're saying aside from the actual. The inevitability of small emergencies going on, people passing out or chest pain, shortness of breath, anxiety, falls, trips and falls. You're talking about stampedes or like what we had actually not too many weeks ago in Boston.
Exactly.
A mass destructive event. A single...
Exactly.
It doesn't have to be a single event, but it's something that's affecting a large percentage of the population there, not just the simple things. And go ahead.
Well, just the idea is when you look at the definition of what is a mass gathering, everyone's got their own version, but the idea is that the mass gathering is going to tax resources in the surrounding area. It's not an isolated event unto itself. So a lot of planners, when they look at mass gatherings, what they've done is they've looked at patient presentation rates of normal occurrences. And then there's kind of usually just a final paragraph that says, and you should be ready to, if there's an escalating of event or if there's an MCI, you should involve your local EMS. What they forget about is local EMS is already dealing with the mess of the periphery of your own event.
Right.
And they're already overextended. So it's the hospitals are overextended, pretty much everyone.
The ambulance company, the fire department can't get into there. They, you know,
they create, you know, mass gatherings, they create their own traffic. So already there's that. And so it was basically what I did was looked at a bunch of different types of events and just kind of see, you know, what other countries, what other places are doing, how were different responses and what's, you know, what could be, what might work.
What's good, what's bad.
Yeah.
And you said you looked at four different events in the thesis, correct?
I looked at, let's see, the first one was the Love Parade disaster, which was a big open-air music festival. It's kind of a strange event, but they had a crowd crush, and I think they ended up with 21 dead. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the total number of injuries, but they... to see how they managed that. And that was basically just a dysfunction of planning. The venue, it was almost predictable that they would have had a disaster, just the way the traffic flows are. So I looked at different causes, but one advantage they had that was interesting is they had totally overestimated the number of people that were going to be at that event.
Mm-hmm.
They had these overestimated amounts that in prior events there were 1 million people, 1.5 million people, that sort of thing.
Right.
So they had planned for nearly that. But then at the end, they ended up enclosing the event, making it a ticketed event. So they had a quarter of that people. I think there were 250,000 people.
Okay.
And so they had medical preparation that was sufficient.
Okay,
because they had overestimated
so
the numbers.
So they had an abundance of ambulance there, caregivers. Did they have, like, mobile units set up?
They had some tents and other things set up. It was, yeah, they had some good tools. But there wasn't a ton of field-level reporting of, like, what had happened there. There was a lot of retrospective analysis from the hospitals. You know, it was interesting, too. They had done some training. They'd done a lot of preparation because they know the Love Parade was going to be a huge drug and alcohol fest. So,
mm-hmm. Of course.
You know, they had done reasonable preparation for that.
Yeah.
And then it's remarkable just how many resources other places are able to... were able to put together, just being like some places that have nationalized healthcare,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're able to come up with an amazing amount of ambulances and that sort of thing. So, yeah, that was one of them. Let's see, there was in 1988, there was a air show at Ramstein Air Force Base.
Right.
And the Italian version of the Blue Angels, who had like three fatal accidents in the prior 10 years or two, you know, one of their jets clipped another one, and they crashed right in the middle of the crowd.
There's YouTube footage of that.
Yeah, it's really messed up.
It's psychotic.
Families, everything. And there was an interest. What I thought was interesting about that case is they had every advantage in the world for planning.
Mm-hmm.
It's on a military base,
right.
So the security part's taken care of. They've been holding the same event for 10 years, and it was a ticket event, so they knew exactly how many people were going to be there.
Right. So that's okay. Interesting.
And you have like a military base, so you've got all these personnel that are trained for trauma and all.
And large scale trauma.
Exactly.
Large scale triaging. You know.
And they had all the best preparation that you could hope for, but then it was just an example of Murphy's Law. The jet crashed into the military medical evac helicopter.
Oh, great!
Someone dropped the communications radios between the head post and the headquarters where they were overlooking the field.
Right.
And so
the tower?
Exactly.
Okay.
But they had the senior medical staff up there, some of them. So they just turned into this Murphy's Law of anything that can go wrong. So. And then what were the other cases? There was the Madrid train bombings, just to see how a different kind of system, they have very different ambulance service here in Spain, but how they were able to respond to a multiple focus terrorist attack. As we talked about the other night, I hadn't realized just how many victims there were. There was 191 dead and almost 2,000 injured.
2,000 people injured. And it was two separate events or three?
There was basically four separate trains had bombs on them. Not all the bombs went off.
Three, okay.
One of the trains was late, was supposed to show up at the same time as another train to just, you know, inflict as many casualties on the platforms in the station. And then, it was pretty remarkable. But again, just they had some lucky things, but then there's it was interesting to see the kind of the variation of their own commentary of what they think of their own performance. There's a pretty wide range, so there's been some critique of that maybe they haven't critiqued themselves enough or applied the lessons learned.
What did they find out that they didn't think, well, they did right, and what they thought they did wrong?
One of the odd things in their analysis was they said, one of their quotes is that triage tags were found to be of little use. This was kind of the official presentation of this particular...
That was the first initial presentation?
Is kind of one of their more official ones. This was from a PowerPoint they gave me.
Okay.
And in their lessons learned, they said triage tags are very questionable, or questionable utility. But when you look at some other analysis or other commentary of the events, they were saying that a lot of the ambulances weren't even carrying their triage tags. Mm. They don't have a unified triage system, so some of the other ambulances services that showed up, they didn't have triage tags. And then just all the confusion and stuff you'd expect from just a multifocal event. But they had so many resources, they were able to throw a lot at them,
mm-hmm.
but they just had some different challenges. Obviously...
Multiple places.
And you're vulnerable to who's the person running each place. some person might have more talent for running that kind of thing, whereas another way... So there was a big variety, not just because of the nature of the event, not just because of the location. Each location had its different challenges.
It's different people facing different challenges in different places.
Yeah.
And they have different IC capabilities.
And so there were different outcomes. And,
right. That's actually an interesting thing to look at because you can see what things worked in each spot and which things didn't. And obviously leadership's going to be crucial, but it's too bad there wasn't like a certain area where they did use triage tags consistently and you're able to analyze that versus another place where it was inconsistent and there was one where there's absolutely nothing.
Exactly. So, yeah, they in their own critique, they didn't really mention their own leadership issues.
Right.
So.
This is getting too loud. Right?
That's what I'm thinking.
All right, we'll take a little pause, ladies and gentlemen. Back when it gets a little bit softer, or we find some place to get soft.
The music that you're listening to is from Omar Valcancel, a Spanish guitar player that I met at Parkwell. After an hour of spending my time in awe listening to him, he gave me the CD for free. He's fantastic, and anytime you're in Spain and Barcelona, I invite you to check him out. He's always playing at the Parkwell. If you're interested in buying a CD, his email address is valcarcel1984@hotmail.com. And he'll hook you up.
We're back, and everybody just left. So they call it bombing?
It pretty much was. That was like a photo bomb.
We were just people bombed.
That was a podcast bomb.
It was a podcast bomb. Fuck them, man.
50 people drinking beers, mobbing through our private public plaza.
The Plaza de la Constitución.
Yes.
That's where we are. This is the Plaza de la Constitución.
The main plazas of San Sebastián. After a good day of castle hopping.
Yeah, well, that was fun.
Yeah.
We went up there. Wasn't really a castle.
So what did we decide? We were talking about the Madrid experience and just their challenges and this and that, just to see how they work.
The issue, with many different areas, so we don't have to recap.
Yeah, and they're to see just following. How a different system works. I mean, for your listeners, of course. Yeah. The ambulances in Spain, or at least the SAMUR service in Madrid, on their ambulances or their advanced life support ambulances. Actually, that's kind of cool. Obviously, the engines don't go to medicals, but they'll send two ambulances, a BLS and an ALS ambulance.
Okay.
But on the ALS ambulance, they have a doctor, a nurse, and an EMT.
That's crazy awesome.
And I was saying the other night, the EMTs have 2 years of school.
2 years of schooling for an EMT.
Exactly.
Paramedics are?
Nurses, I think, are like 4 to 6 years. There are no medics. Medics don't exist.
Okay. Okay, so they just go right up to nurse and they go to a doctor.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's a totally different gig. I actually got had some little experience interacting with them. We were coming back with my friends from Marrakesh, and we were in the taxi, and we managed to hit a lady. We didn't hit the lady. The taxi.
Taxi driver did.
The lady, actually, she was wasted, and she fell into the street just as our taxi was coming.
Hope feet first.
Went right over the...
Jesus.
Went right over the ambulance.
Jeez.
So she's...
Or the taxi.
Down in the street.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, I'd start, you know, dealing with her. Just, it was...
Do you jump out and do C-spine? Say, I'm a paramedic. Me llamo es Josh. Yo soy un paramedic.
No, I didn't say I'm a paramedic because they don't really know what that is.
They don't know what that is. So of course not. That was a trick question. You pass that one. Keep going.
It was a straight up... it was a good TL patient. She was a little inebriated.
Okay.
Bleeding of the head.
Let's go a little closer.
Doing the whole...
you can turn that way. Just he wants to recline, you guys, and he's...
Well,
he's looking very Spanish, okay? He's sitting back, his hair slicked back.
Slick back.
He's got his legs extended as far as you can get him, and he's leaning. He's canting over to the side, and he's got his thumb and his forefinger on his chin. He's really getting contemplative.
I am not. I am reliving a tense medical adventure moment.
It looked like it.
Yeah,
by your demeanor. Yeah, go on.
But it was just funny how things are the same no matter where you're at. Mm-hmm. She's wasted.
Yeah.
Sitting here, getting the basic questions that just kind of, you know, you're asking all the basic questions. Do you have any of this? Do you have any of that? Go through medical history.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, she denies any medical history as she's bleeding all over my hands.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the ambulance arrives, goes through medical history. She's like, oh, yes. No, actually, I have HIV.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, it's all the same.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank you,
dear.
Ma'am. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm going to go wash my hands now.
Jesus.
So anyway, the point of that was that that was my interaction with them, and just seeing how that works with the nurse, the doctor, and I think one of the challenges they may have had, and this is just my own musings, but I think one of the challenges they may have had spreading out, dealing with such a mass casualty, they're so used to having so many resources that they can maintain their normal hierarchy, doctor, nurse, technical, you know, EMT.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden they're faced with more patients that they've ever dealt with. Yet you were still sometimes seeing these groupings.
Right, so they're staying together.
They're staying instead
in a trio,
of spreading out.
Rather than doing triage and breaking apart.
I don't think they have the same sort of autonomy. And they have, even though they have these amazing numbers of ambulances, they don't have, you know, whatever my thoughts are on the fire-based EMS, you do have a lot more EMTs and medics available to you, or at least EMTs of hands and people who have experience in a situation like that.
Very true.
With a little medical experience.
It's kind of like the U.S. military in World War II. They were able to, even though they get separated in a, you know, in an airdrop, each one of them can basically start acting autonomously. They get two or three guys together and say, well, we need to take care of this target, we need to take care of this target. Whereas if you look at the German military, they'd say, shoot the officer. These guys don't know what to do after that.
Huh.
That was the whole key to it. But Americans were the ones that were able to just say, well, we all are briefed on the same things. We know what we have to do. So even if we get separated, we know how to react and move. And it's much the same way, I would say, with San Francisco or with any fire department. You're on enough calls, you're doing something, you know your crew is all able to see it, understand it, and they're able to translate it. If it's a good crew, they can move out, and you trust them to do it, I think, is the other thing, too.
You are full of history.
I'm throwing it out there, man. I'm making analogies.
Well, that's one thing they don't have here as well. There's nothing comparable to incident command system.
Oh, really?
So that was trying to explain that to them, what it was, the history of it, just basically saying, look, we all speak this common language, whether we speak it well or not. You know, even to this day, I think one of my frustrations with all these large-scale events or the ones that I was at is I don't like mass gatherings. I don't like that kind of medicine. I don't like any of that stuff. But it was almost based just in insecurity, frustration, and fear that I got the motivation or the interest in this, because I just felt like, you know, even with all the time that, you know, over the last, 10 months that I've dedicated to this, I just even still feel like that I personally am not as well-versed as I should be when it comes to ICS and all this kind of stuff for when it does matter.
Yes.
Even especially after studying these events. I mean, I couldn't even... I went to Real Madrid, their soccer game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all I could do is just sit there and look at the crowds and look at the stadium. You know, because it was all fresh in my mind. I'm
just
like,
man,
somebody explodes. Where do I go?
Imagine this. Yeah, escape routes. What do we do? How do we get out of here?
Where's the crowd crush going to be? Where's the, you know, all that kind of stuff. So
that's so funny. You totally think like a medic.
Well, not, especially when it's you're so primed on it in your head.
True.
I've had a couple weeks now since I had my the defense of the thesis a few weeks ago, which I renamed the Spanish Inquisition. It's a very formal affair, you know, tie, and there's a panel, and you have to sit
good
down,
God.
And you do a whole presentation, and they question you on your deal. And, you know, obviously with a little insecurity with the language.
That's tough.
You know, I was just nervous that I was going to miss a question or not understand what in the world they were talking about or just have, you know, it just...
Just freeze up?
A fantastic brain fart in the middle of it. Yeah. Trying to, you know...
just a big, juicy brain fart.
Exactly. Just,
I don't even... What if you just...
I'll just nod and smile.
Oh, Joshua Smith, have you got your thesis ready?
Pretty much. Pretty okay. much. I was a little nervous for that.
But I think, wait, I just got to say, and this goes for everybody, you studied the one thing that you're afraid of, you don't like, you're awkward with, and you made that your study. And I don't think people realize, they say go after what you know. That's true. You know medicine, you know emergency medicine. You're an amazing medic. Everybody loves Josh, by the way, this guy. The reason why he got an extension...
Not so much.
And we can talk about it. But yeah, there's never been a full year extension for any...
Officially.
Okay, officially. Any extension given to a firefighter, an SFFD employee in the history of SFFD.
And that's
official.
At least according to the chief's letter she gave me when she first denied my... But
and there you have.
Moving on,
he got a year extension. And the reason is not just because it involves San Francisco. The reason is Josh's character. I'm telling you that because he won't say it. But
he had the extension because there were some very nice people who apparently
very, very
went
nice
to bat for me a little bit and whispered in an ear. So that
right.
was very nice.
You made good friends because you do a good job. But I think what I'm saying is you also have to do the thing that scares you because it makes you better. It makes you better. It makes you do your other easy stuff more easily. And you challenge your mind.
I was pissed, too. I was angry because, like, you see in all these, not all these disasters, but a lot of disasters, what's the soundbite that happens afterwards when everyone's looking to assign blame, and this is when changes happen, is in the heat afterwards, and not when it's a good time, but people are looking for people to blame. It's the natural thing. Even while I was here, there was a crowd crush there was an arena, Madrid Arena, on Halloween. Bunch of kids, like, oversold the event. They did, you know, everything wrong. There was a crowd crush, and I think 4 or 5 girls died.
Okay.
You know, and then it's all the political repercussions that have after. Everyone's assigning blame. This person's blame,
right.
That person, whatever.
Everybody money more quarterbacks it, yeah.
And then, but then you see the news footage of whatever event, and you see whatever official saying, we never could have predicted this. And I just want to scream, like, bullshit. I mean, these things are out there. There are mass casualties, disasters that happen at the events, you know, obviously not every day, but frequently enough, a couple times a year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look through the history. I mean, in the Hajj in Mecca, 5,000 people killed, you know, in a crowd crush. Or, you know, these things happen year after year. And it's one of the things in the paper is I found, like, a chart. It's an incomplete chart, but of casualties and events going back, whatever, 150-something years of these are not, you know... There was one in the East Coast a couple months ago. There was like a fire at a... Oh, I can't remember. I thought it was like a fire at a nightclub or something like that.
There was a Great White thing that happened, the band, when that place caught
right.
fire. But that was years ago. I'm trying to remember what you're talking about.
There's been so many disasters over the last few months between all the shootings
no
and everything
doubt.
Else going on.
This old hurricane or the cyclone that came through.
Exactly.
It's predictable. We know it's going to happen.
Right.
It's been happening. I mean, look at San Francisco. Since 1906, you know it's going to happen.
Right. And we talked about where the USGS said 62% chance between that 30-year period of this that we're in the middle of, that there's going to be another major earthquake.
Between 2010 and 2060?
No, it was like 2012 to 32 or 2002 to 32 or whatever it is.
Okay.
But here's a perfect 60% example.
60% chance.
So you have the mass gathering of people. You already know this is a cluster as it is.
Here they come. They're bombing us.
Luckily, that's a smaller group of podcast
and
bombers.
And they're indigent, and they're also mobile.
And they don't... Well, at least they're not armed with beer.
Not yet. Not yet, anyway. We're lucky.
So you have these mass gatherings where stuff happens. It doesn't matter what the trigger is. Sometimes it could be a weather event. It could be this or that. But so think about the 89 earthquake. What was going on at the time?
We had the World Series.
Right. So you got Candlestick, holds almost 70,000 people. Game was just starting. They hadn't all gotten there. It was, I think there was 50 to 60,000 people in there. Mm-hmm. There was some little, you know, cracks and failure. But imagine, you know, that's a perfect example of an event that's going to create its own problems. But imagine if there was a stadium failure at that point, or there's the crush at that point.
Yeah.
And then it's even more complicated because it's a regional event. It's not an isolated event where you're going to... No. Mutual aid is a little busy around you, so don't expect the cavalry to come. So mm-hmm. The whole point of this thing is, how do we plan mass gathering events in a way that at least we can be better equipped to deal with a mass casualty during the times of operation?
Mm-hmm.
And the other main point is, using those events or using mass gatherings, every time we have one, use it as a training scenario for MCIs. You assign all the roles. Everyone's got their MCI leadership positions ahead of time. The communication channels already done for an escalating event. Everything's already distributed. Hospitals know about an event because after, you know, in whatever study, whatever hospital's closest to the event is going to get saturated first. We already, in San Francisco, we got the medic to follow phenomena in level zero and other counties and all that kind of stuff. So you're going to have the hospital's closest. Like, for example, one of the cases was not one that I studied, but just reference the sarin gas attack in Tokyo. In these large-scale events, it's between 80 and 85% of patients transport themselves.
Mm-hmm.
No one's waiting around for EMS, you know, so they're showing up at the hospitals. The hospitals may start receiving patients with little or no warning. So how do you manage, you know... Let the hospitals know ahead of time that at least you're having this event. They're the closest one. They can prepare for traffic. They can practice their recall. You know,
right. And is that not happening now?
Not to the amount that it should. I can't speak for other counties, but when it comes to not enough hospital and community involvement and that sort of thing. So if you can get all these, especially in the U.S., because we don't have a nationalized health system. Everyone, we got all these different actors, private ambulance, public ambulance, fire departments, different hospitals, different private hospitals, everyone with their own agenda, everyone's doing their own thing, but all these people are going to have to work together in a big event.
Yeah.
So if you can kind of get them at least getting those contact lines, oh, here's your bell.
Here we go. This is ambience, roughly.
If you can at least get your these people... having this contact and building relationships, so when the big disaster happens, you're not meeting them for the first time. You've worked together. You know each other. You have that. So,
you already have some, like you said. I think, and I think it goes out. Like if there, I would hope that you have some sort of daily teletype thing that goes out saying this event because we have it for the fire department, right? And by the look on your face, you can't see. It obviously is not.
Whether it goes out or not, it's whether it gets distributed to throughout. I'm sure it does go out.
To different agencies, between hospitals, private ambulances, and the department and first responders.
And
is everybody getting briefed in the morning?
Well, that's the thing. And think of the difference of the advantage that the fire service has versus a medic service, you know, which is what I'm a part of, you know, the EMS division. You already know it's herding cats. Trying to get medics together on anything, much less decide on what kind of pizza, but on anything. But we all start our shifts at different hours, so there's no morning
briefing.
Exactly. So no, it's very rare that we're, and because we're so autonomous, we show up, we grab our ambulance, we do our own thing. You know.
Mm-hmm. Hey, brother, mi hermano. Yeah.
And they're armed with beers. This could take a while.
Just enjoy this. Just enjoy this, everybody.
Well, this is a soccer game tonight.
I'm just happy to be here like us,
there we
Josh.
Go. Okay. We
got a little tour guide. Now we have a tour here. This is lovely. Looks like it's in English.
So anyway, without exhausting like the whole topic of what the whole thing was about,
Well, no, let's exhaust it. You raise such an interesting point because you don't even think about the fact that all it needs is a morning bulletin or something like a board above
a board above the when you go into work above the dispatch office or wherever you get your controlled narcs or whatever, it just says this event's going on. These are the channels. Or just he could be on a piece of paper. Hey, this event, and we're going to be on TAC 32, or we're going to be on whatever.
And if there's
if and when.
And even more so, if there's an escalating event, this is going to be the medical channel. Because inevitably, for every major event like I've been to, communications plans seem to change halfway through, and you don't hear that there's a new TAC channel. And so I can't even tell you, you know, whatever the event is, fire or whatever, show up. And the rescue captain's looking at me like, I've been trying to raise you on the medical channel. It's like, well, they never broadcast it out on, because there's the control channel, then there's the channel for if it's a large enough incident, but then they might start adding other channels. It's like, well, they never broadcast it on this one, or it didn't come up on the computer, or, you know, you just, and that's where things go wrong when just like in the Ramstein event, you know, it's that's the kind of chaos that any one of these events are going to cause. If there's a weakness, it's just it's going to happen, like, you know.
Right.
In the German, the Love Parade thing, you know, they were right at a shift change, so there weren't as many police as there might have been otherwise. All these little vulnerabilities, it's just going to happen. Mm-hmm. Someone's going to drop the radios. Someone's going to, you know,
forget what channel we're on.
Exactly, and that's what always creates some of the frustration in the chaos. Someone has their mic keyed and they don't realize it. You know, these are the little things that cause catastrophic failures.
Well, because you're walking such a tightrope already. It's just it's so easily fallible.
Exactly.
And the fact that this is just seldom used thing, that nobody really knows how to enact it. It's not your regular situation.
And so the idea is if you can practice it every time.
Which is what you're trying to do.
You say, you know what, we're having a major event. You know, you have who are the crews that are going to be working it. If something happens, you're going to be, you're going to be MGS. You're going to be...
What's MGS? Medical group supervisor?
Yeah, medical group supervisor. Okay. You're going to be the staging officer. Because the other thing that does, it gives them a moment to get out the charts, look at the job, remember what it is. Because, you know, luckily in the department, we did have a pretty good, very realistic training for MCI during our academy. Mm-hmm. But even so, to expect whatever... other agency to have had the same, you know, when I worked for the privates, there's nothing.
No.
There was no training.
Absolutely not.
And there was even a reticence because just the money wasn't there to allow us to participate in other large-scale trainings. And because you're out there doing the job, when they do have the large-scale training, guess what? Most people are working the job. They can't go to the training because, you know.
They're on shift.
There's no time out.
And they're not going to give you time, OT or whatever, to go to that.
Exactly. So if you can use these events, then you have different people coming through, different you know, captains who are running it, different people, and then it's an ongoing thing. You have the relationships. Other elements are you have the disaster supplies staged there. You get out, you get your hands on them. Like in San Francisco, we have different materials, but different agencies have them.
Do you keep them in like a trailer and they wheel them up and you don't really get a chance to look at them? Or you know what I mean?
There's not enough hands-on. So what's going to happen in a disaster? Someone's going to say, go get this out of that.
You go,
and it's like, whoa, I don't even know what that is. You know, I don't know where you keep it. And next thing you know, you're spending 10 minutes. Or if there's a disaster, and let's say in San Francisco, one of the resources is a mass casualty unit. Well, you know, it's staged up wherever it is, you know, in that station. And then it's going to start responding. Well, guess what? The disaster creates traffic and havoc. Now you have a delayed response of getting this resource there. Well, what do they always say? It's the first minutes of an MCI that are the critical one to have it set up correctly.
Right.
Well, if you have everyone assigned jobs, you have the radio channels already assigned, you have the equipment already there, that 85% of people, you know what? They may stick around a little longer if they see things are being managed. What was interesting about the Boston deal is they were lucky. In the sense that the disaster, the bombs happened right next to the medical tent.
Oh, beautiful.
So they had that resource right there, but then what they didn't have was maybe enough security, because then they had to clear everyone out to make sure that there wasn't a bomb in the medical tent as a secondary, a secondary device to take out responders and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets into all those different elements, and that's kind of the crux of it. So I think the final one, I just kind of did a compare and contrast in San Francisco. Of the two events of the Giants Parade, where we did have some resources, a lot of it was improvised. A lot of it was it relied on the experience of I mean, to watch one of our RC captains, Jim Fizakerly, and then Megan working together, they were having, like, fun. They were having, like, a good old time. I was
sure
just sitting there looking around.
They're
just, you know, they have the experience, and they were comfortable, and it was
correct,
actually kind
right.
of fun to watch. And then Doc Brown was able to bring in one of the DMAT, it's like a emergency response hospital team, whatever. He was able to get them in there to set up a medical care facility. And so mm-hmm. that took a lot of pressure off the system. And then versus another event where there was a New Year's where we didn't have as many resources, and it was just, you know, we were completely overwhelmed.
So you definitely saw the effectiveness of having something established.
The potential, yeah. And that's where they've now expanded. They've done, you know, sobering tents, which is a huge thing. Because now, you know, that's one of our biggest customers during these events of mass inebriation. You know, you're overwhelming hospitals. You're spending time transporting people slowly because they're not sick to faraway hospitals because the close ones are all full.
Right.
And it's just this cascading phenomena of now, because the hospitals are full, all your medics are now waiting in line in triage. They can't transfer care. Meanwhile, all the calls are stacking up.
The actual sick patients
exactly.
are really in trouble. And you've just exhausted the system with drunks that don't actually need help. They
exactly.
need to sleep.
So they've started little by little. They've added more and more resources along those lines. It's been pretty successful. I mean, some they've taken 30, 40, 50 patients,
mm-hmm.
which is, that's 30, 40,
that's
50 ambulances. That's 30, you know, some yeah. of them they've had to transport by ambulance, but 30, 40, 50 emergency room beds. I mean, what's an average ER? How many beds do they have?
I don't know, 20?
On a good day, yeah.
You know?
If it's a bigger ER.
You just need to monitor them to make sure they don't choke on their own puke or whatever.
Exactly.
Anybody can do that.
So that's, that. It was building on some of
those. Should do that.
On some of those things.
Very good. Very good stuff.
Yeah.
So the crux of it is this. You need to have some sort of pre-plan set up. It needs to be practiced at large events that don't have any sort of emergency situation set up.
And every time
in
you
order
do
to
it.
Practice it
yeah.
and then I assume sit around at some point, find the time and find the personnel, the people that worked it, come together, express how it went.
Exactly.
How was it, you know, going through these things? Do you remember this equipment? How was this equipment working? Did you notice it was effective?
And getting it in people's hands. I mean, even things like I mentioned the other night, in Spain they've got, or in Madrid at least, they've got these, like, blow-up tents. I mean, if you could have different the treatments, like the drunks go here, critical patients go here, you're already set up for your levels of triage. You have one green tent, a yellow tent, a red tent.
Right.
You know, it's always going to depend on the size of the event. The nature of the event, is it mobile? Is it like beta breakers? Obviously, that has different challenges than, you know, because, you know, it's a moving drunken mob as opposed to
right.
a stationary drunken mm-hmm. mob.
A stadium, if you will, or
I
something
mean,
like that. Or
I mean, that's the perfect example of a non-self-contained event. The planners are supposed to have, well, there's X amount of participants. We're supposed to have X amount of people. It's like, no. We're finding people in the bushes in the park
right.
going late in the night, and then we're also taking patients out of the jails. We're taking patients off the buses. Meanwhile, in theory, it's being handled by the private agencies who are contracted to run the event. No. We're running the whole periphery of the shit show because it's just spilling out all over the place.
Right.
That's the... That's part of the argument. So it'll be interesting. If nothing else, the worst case scenario, at least I feel like if there were another disaster, I can sit there and think, you know what? There's this argument was made. The plan was out there. So the next time a politician or whomever person comes up on the news and says, we never could have expected, we never could have planned for something like this. There's something else saying, you know what? Yes, you could have. And you've been told and you've been warned and in these days of so little training, it would be an opportunity where we can practice, do the training, and be a little more prepared.
Absolutely. And go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, if anything, these disasters show you, you're never going to be. It's going to be, by definition, it's a disaster. It's going to be.
Yes.
It's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be, you know, hopefully a day I'm in Mexico on vacation.
Right.
But at the same time.
But your paper's there, so you put your time in. Don't worry about it.
But at the same time, you also want to be there.
Of course you do. Of course. You do, and I do, and, you know, right. anybody who loves the job wants to be there because we can think on our feet.
Right.
But if there's something established preliminarily,
we're going to need all the help we can get. We're golden. This is all I'm saying.
And yeah, I mean, well, the thing that is so crazy is even if you brief everybody in San Francisco, what you're saying by having to bring in ancillary medical care means you're going to have to bring in San Mateo, you're going to have to bring in San Bruno, you know, maybe Tiburon or Marin County or whatever, you know, Southern Marin, to work these things. Are they being briefed? Are they getting any of the information? Absolutely not. None of that's happening.
And it's always the little things that'll slow down the whole system. It'll be like something like one of the ambulances from Tiburon doesn't have a map to the city. Or, you know, it's all those little logistical things. Or someone doesn't have the key to open the door to that specific room. Or,
right.
You know, it's always...
Oh, yeah. Well, it's impossible. It's almost impossible.
But yeah, looking...
Thinking on your feet, I think, solves probably 90% of the problems.
And one of the strengths that they showed in the Madrid case was the thinking on the feet, people improvising. So there was one instance where one of the trains that was late, it blew up on the tracks around the corner from the station where another train had also blown up. Mm-hmm. There was some confusion because it was right near that station, the Atocha station, so they thought they already had it handled because this one was getting called in as Atocha as well. So it was only two ambulances for like almost an hour were by themselves managing a train of, you know, how many, I can't remember, but probably 30, 40, 50, 60 dead and, you know, God. X amount of injured. But what did they do? This was one of the successful cases. There was a gymnasium that hadn't yet opened up. They opened up the doors to the gymnasium. They got all the patients in there. They yelled up to the surrounding apartment buildings. People were throwing down
blankets
and pillows. Volunteers came in and they were assigned pretty much one-to-one to a patient.
Beautiful.
So people were at least standing by, you know, patients and that sort of thing. And so volunteers are another big part
of it. That's a huge part of it. You don't think about, and well, like the 89 quake, remember there was that whole moment where the Phoenix, the water boat was stuck there. They had to hump like 2,000, well, it might have been even 5,000 line of large diameter hose in. How are they going to hump that from the bay over into the marina district? And the captain just said, all right, all you guys standing here that want to do something, start humping hose. And these
exactly.
and all the people, you know, people want to help. People want to be important, and you recruit them in, pull them in,
when
have them hump hose, or hold a bandage, or talk to somebody, or say, hey, this guy is dying here. Can you help me with this guy? He's no longer conscious.
And volunteers can be both a blessing, but they can also be a burden.
Of course they can.
Then you have to dedicate resources. If they're not trained volunteers, hey, there's your bell.
I like him.
Then you got to dedicate resources to managing volunteers.
Right.
And just the distraction, because like you said, people,
well, obviously. It's interesting because it almost works in your advantage if they're not trained in medical things, because they just sit and do the real mundane stuff, and when something happens, they will see it and alert you, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
You almost don't want the in-between first responder type guy, because they may think, well, I can handle this and
they'll
not realize.
They'll be holding C-spine on the dead person.
Right, thinking they're doing something good rather than just going, I don't know what's going on, but this guy's really sick. Give me a hand here.
So volunteers was another big part of it. You know, if you can incorporate them, like whether it's the San Francisco has NERD, I'm sure other
neighborhood emergency response team.
Yes.
Right.
And if they had a little more of a training component or understanding the principles of triage, because one of the difficulties is people start demanding, you know, for it's, you know, some of the expectant people, which is awful, they start, you know,
consume a lot of
resources.
Right.
But, oh God, there's an awful blog.
Nearly dead, yeah.
There's an awful blog, not awful, it's actually very instructive. A survivor from the Ramstein event, he was classified pretty much as expectant, based on what you can tell from his experience.
Mm-hmm.
He had just lost his wife and child. And he tells in his blog about how he could tell that that's what was going on, that he was being, and he just started screaming. And so they classified him up.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up, you know, just surviving. But imagine an event like that. Here you have a plane crash, jet fuel, all these burned people. And then think of, at least in San Francisco, our burn center. How many beds do they really have? I mean,
Well, they wouldn't go there, I guess, first. They'd probably go to General.
They would. Yeah, they would. If associated trauma, but I guess if they just got torched and nothing else, but, you know, who knows? But yeah, exactly, blast injuries. That was one of the weaknesses in Spain. They found this, there wasn't enough training to understand.
Well, it's all this new stuff that we have not, as Americans, had to deal with until 2001, really. That was the wake-up call. But, I mean, Spain, a lot of Europe, obviously, Israel. You know, you have they have this stuff established. And the London bombings, right?
And look, you look at Afghanistan. I mean, there's
of course
things blowing up there every week.
Yes,
you know, something 10 times the scale of Boston, but happening every, you know, pretty frequently.
It was not fun. I'll tell you that. That sucked in the middle of the night. You just hear, boom.
See, I don't even know how you slept over it.
That's you just, don't.
That's unreasonable.
I mean, talk about, you know, when you go on an emergency call and you get the alarm goes off and you're sleeping. It's a little different when you actually hear the event that you're going to be dispatched to.
And you would consider going back?
I would think about it. I think that I did a good job there, and I want to go back and help. But the thing is this. You talk about, we're going to get into this with these homeboys walking down the street. But getting civilians trained in this stuff. My whole thing with EMT is, I believe, just like Israel trains, they all have to go into the military for a mandatory 2 years, I think. There should be a mandatory high school class.
That would be awesome.
Anatomy, physiology, basic emergency care for every single student. Everybody. Just CPR and first aid. You would not believe how many times we show up on a call and there's just a dead body there. They went down, family watched them, and they've been lying on the ground for the last 5 minutes or 8 minutes or 10 minutes.
Or surrounded by a room of physicians.
And nobody's yes, I know. And nobody's doing anything because they're afraid to do something rather than just that whole point. Just do what he's trying to, the point he's trying to make. There they come. My point is, just do something. But learn that something. Take that class. It's got to be a mandatory class. Shit, one semester out of your high school career spent on basic emergent care, BLS care. If you like it, go into the field. If not, you have it.
I think that's a great idea.
Josh, that's what we have to do. We have to set this up.
Well, one of the good things they also have here, or they have in Madrid, is they have a huge volunteer corps that are uniformed, trained, and who go out on the ambulances. So a lot of these events, they have this whole volunteer thing. So they had, I can't remember what it was, but within the first hour, they had made over 900 phone calls to volunteers, you know, who could respond to these events.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they have a huge, just the whole concept of civil protection in Europe. You know, has that kind of principle where, you know, the cavalry is not going to arrive in a large scale event. There's going to be no one to respond because everyone's overwhelmed. So
we are our own cavalry.
Echoing your point, yeah, there needs to be, and people feel empowered. There's going to be less, at least if they feel like they know what they can do or should do, it's going to make a big difference, just in their own psyche.
I agree. Yeah, just knowing, well, I did everything that I could do for that patient, rather than, because that's the thing that would bother me, is seeing somebody dead and not knowing what to do, and that feeling of indecision and no confidence in what you can do, and just watching something go down would be, that's hellish.
Exactly.
Yes.
So what else you got?
What else is going on?
I don't
know. I'm just waiting for this guy to come back. We get another little glass of wine here.
Oh, that'd be lovely.
Yeah. That was great stuff. And now, here, this is the thing I was amazed at. You're saying that the ambulance services there not only have a doctor and a nurse working there, but they have, like, sonograms on the ambulances.
They've got all sorts of stuff. And, you know, obviously I didn't, you know, understand what half the stuff was. But they got all sorts of, and then the antibiotics, they have. And then, like as we talked about, they have the whole other service, which is their SAMUR, which stands for something.
What is it? SONA?
S-A-M-U-R.
SAMUR.
It's the service of the Ayuntamiento of Madrid, of urgencies. Remember we discussed it, like the other emergency, or I think that is. And then I think Rescate, which is, rescue.
Mm-hmm.
And they're training when it comes to all the hazmat, when it comes to all the, I mean, it's amazing. And then They also have ability to, I think they have a little more ability to deny service or at least refer to other resources.
Mm-hmm,
so they can have their
non-emergent.
Exactly. They have a whole other social service kind of like an ambulance, but similar, mm-hmm. but not an ambulance, that they can refer people to.
Mm-hmm.
So they can say, you know what, there's no reason for you. But also the culture, you know, it's all very different.
Well, that's the thing, is this is all government funded.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what, you want to look at some plus sides of socialism. This is definitely, by the way, not many homeless have I seen in any of these cities so far.
Like I said, Spain is the strongest argument for that kind of system and against. You know, if you hate the system, you're going to find plenty of things just with, you know, the economy and the dysfunction and all that sort of thing. But at the same time, you know, you look at the public spaces, there's universal health care, there's, you know, the streets are clean, there's the, you know, it has its advantages.
It will, but it depends on, I think, a stable country where you don't have a large influx of people on a regular basis. The people that are still there paying their taxes and actually investing in the government to pay you back. It kind of is absolutely, it's necessary for that to happen in order for it to work.
It's just a matter, it's just a matter of what services you want.
Circumventing the system.
Yeah?
Is that it?
Circumventing?
I know, that was a reference to...
Waiter, we need some more wine, sir.
Sir, some red. No, that's from Arrested Development, baby.
Oh, I know I miss half your movie references. Oh,
come on, man. That's a joke. Yeah, that's my one thing that I would say. Social would be great. It would work if you had everybody paying into it. When you don't, it don't work.
So that was essentially the disorganized version of what the... what part of the paper was about. I mean, it was just given an opportunity to... I got to be in my bonnet about the theme because of those, you know, a couple of experiences where I didn't feel necessarily as prepared as I thought that I should, or as a system that we should, just knowing the training that I have received. And, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, don't feel ready.
You're doing it, man. You just set something up for the city.
And, I mean... And I've already told you, there's no mistake. It was an excellent excuse to be in Spain and learn some other things and have some other experiences. And
well, like you said yesterday,
take a little break from that potential EMS fizzle.
You said yesterday you came here to do your master's, and if anything, if you didn't pass it, at least you learned your Spanish more.
Yeah, it was a master's in emergency security. Crisis and Spanish.
Yeah, it's a two-pronged attack.
A few other, you know, Spanish culture. And
oh, yeah, a little time in Marrakesh and, you know,
ham,
have some
and
fun.
Wine.
Some ham, yeah. You have some pinchos.
Cheese. And
little tapas.
Exactly. These are postgraduate studies of you know, well, food and wine.
It's also important for the emergency caregiver to give himself some time off, to enjoy life, to rejuvenate.
To remember what life is.
Yes.
To remember that, to regain, refocus reality, that reality is not the Tenderloin of San Francisco.
Yeah. Not everybody is looking for a handout and or dying of some sort of diabetic-related disease or you know, COPD or whatnot.
Exactly. There are healthy people in the world.
And friendly people. And they're willing to help you.
Exactly.
That's the vibe, though. You got to remember that. You got to stay mentally sound. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to think. In your emergency situation, you're going to be too stressed out.
Or you just bring too much baggage and you're too...
Fuck that noise, right?
Yeah. Too likely to not respond as you should.
So, other than that, how was your year?
Can't complain. I'm in Spain.
Can't complain because the rain falls mainly in the plains or San Sebastian.
It does fall in San Sebastian or any day. I'm batting 1,000 when it comes to taking trips and hitting the rain, but that's just doesn't matter.
You're the rainmaker, man.
Just doesn't matter. It's too beautiful here.
This has been a good year so far. We got this podcast going. We got this established. I was able to take this time off to come here, hang out with you, hang out with my buddy Larry Sweetman in Ireland, and speak about medicine. It's been... look at that. Beautiful. Beautiful. A little bit of wine going.
So another fine Spanish wine is showing up. The Ramon Bilbao. Now will it pick up that sound? That's the important part.
That's important. William Potente.
Bueno, gracias.
Oh, it's better than the first one. It's even better.
Gracias. Gracias. You see that? I think the Castilian on that, some be. He respected that.
If you got to get the TH, then it'll be gracias.
Gracias.
A little TH. A subtle TH.
That was a little on that tip.
Exactly.
Threw a little English on there, even though we're in Spain. So we're going to see some interesting pilgrimage trail stuff through Spain, with any luck. What's the plan here? We're going to
Barcelona.
Barcelona.
Going to Barcelona, where you can practice your Catalan.
Sí, gracias. Madrid.
Yeah, you'll check out Madrid, and then I'll send you off on a couple of jaunts to Lee, Segovia, Toledo. And then you should do at least one city down south. Like, if you can go down to Sevilla, I was blown away. You'll enjoy some hot weather.
I'm going to get a haircut in Sevilla.
I need a haircut.
No, keep yours. I'm just thinking it'd be awesome to get a haircut by a barber in Sevilla.
Barber in Seville. We had a whole thing when we were traveling, like almost 20 years ago. We were going through we'd be in a town, we'd be in Sevilla, and we're like, look, it's a barber in Sevilla. We'd pass ahead. Yeah. So every town we were in, you know, of course, Spain, there'd be a fly. We're like, look, a Spanish fly. So it just kept going and going and building. And I'm probably definitely going to hell for this one, but we're in Venice, and a blind guy walks by, and he's like, look, it's a Venetian blind.
Get the fuck out of here.
It took a couple. I felt a few flames on my toes as I just collapsed in the middle of the street, just laughing. Right after my friend had said that one, I'm like, wow.
The water started boiling.
Wow, that one.
So signing off right now from the podcast,
for now,
it's Ken Allen with Josh Smith, saying if you got it, use it. Nice job. Once again,